This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Scientists have been pondering why all our carbon was not showing up as higher temperatures. While extreme weather seems on the increase, climate change deniers are talking about a long pause in warming. Two Canadian scientists have finally figured out where the heat is. We've reached Robert Way, a doctoral student at the University of Ottawa, along with University of York computational scientist Kevin Cowton. Robert just published a startling study in the Quarterly Journal of the Royal Meteorological Society. They've got scientists talking and media calling from all over the world after finding planet Earth is warming more than twice the previously accepted figures. Robert Way is from Labrador in Canada's north, and Robert, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Before we get technical, what is the big problem you and Kevin set out to solve?
I should start out at the outset and say that Kevin Cowton is from the University of York in the United Kingdom, not in Canada. There is a York University in Canada, but he's from the UK, so just figured I'd clarify that. The problem that, in essence, we've tried to find a solution to, or at least improve upon, is simply a matter of, in several of the most recent types of global temperature analysis, there's been a gap in the Arctic and in other parts of the world where they did not have observational stations. And our goal was to, in essence, simply find a manner of being able to better estimate how temperatures are changing in those regions. And ultimately, it led to this startling result that you've described. But the actual project itself was simply aimed at better understanding how temperatures have changed in some of these isolated regions in the Antarctic, in the Arctic, in Africa, etc.
Previous calculations of global warming showed only half a degree rise per decade since the 1990s, let's say. And I know scientists bend over backwards trying to find out where the heat went, with the consensus being that it went into the oceans. Where was it really?
Well, I think it's been an interesting year, certainly, in that you've seen a few studies that have been published on, yes, there's been the one regarding the PDO and the ocean. There's been several other alternatives proposed, like that there's been more volcanism, that there's been more human aerosol generation and things like that. For us, our result simply shows that over the past 15 years, the majority of the warming that has occurred in the Arctic, and the Arctic has warmed at a rate that's been 8 times the rest of the planet. And I think we've seen certainly the results of this in the dramatic reductions in sea ice and also in changes to glaciers and in ice core records, which are showing very high melt rates now, especially in the eastern Canadian Arctic. So our study is simply a matter of we've found that the Arctic is warming quicker than the rest of the planet by a significant margin. And this is something other scientists have known, but I believe in the case of using the global temperature records we've used, we're the first to actually put an exact number as to what kind of underestimation was occurring.
It seems wild that leading institutions from NASA to Hadley to Potsdam might have missed what you found. How is that possible?
Just to say at the outset, I wouldn't say they've missed it. I know that, for instance, Hadley in the United Kingdom, their Met Office, they released a memo 2 or 3 years ago where they actually said straight out that their observational database, because it's incomplete in the Arctic, they assume that they are catching the bottom end of the warming. And that was in their own release. Now, they didn't quantify what that meant, but they said, based on their paper that they produced, that they know that they're missing some warming in the Arctic. NASA, they use a different method. NASA does interpolate, so they estimate the temperatures at the polar regions, and they incorporate that into their model. Our record, using the Hadley database, we have more than twice the rate of warming, but we're a lot closer to NASA's record. And frankly, if NASA was using let's say there's still a remaining bias in some sea surface temperature records that they have not incorporated yet, but that Hadley has, when they incorporate that, their trends will come in very similar to ours, or that's what our preliminary tests have found, for NASA at least. For both NOAA and for the Met Office in the UK, both of their temperature records don't include the Arctic for the most part.
So the IPCC, though, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, they've been reporting the low end as well all this time. Is that so?
Well, when they use these particular temperature databases, such as Hadley, such as NOAA, they do also include NASA. But when they use those databases, in essence, they were showing the low end. And what they were missing was certainly some degree of that warming that was occurring in the Arctic in particular.
Well, how much has it warmed in the last decade or 15 years? What's the rate?
Well, the rate in the Arctic has been at 8 times the global average. The global average temperature in our record has been at about 0.12 degrees per decade. By comparison, the initial estimate from the Met Office data was around 0.05. So ours is up over 2 times the rate of warming recorded in the Met Office data, and the Arctic is warming at 8 times that rate. So it's a very quick rate in the Arctic, certainly. And this is, in particular, you know, the last decade we've seen very much so what the impacts of a rapidly warming Arctic can be. Our corrected record is at 0.12.
Okay. Well, we have an educated audience here at Radio EcoShock, but none of us is really ready for the extreme math and the super specialist terms that you would have had to dive into. Can you break down for us how you did make this discovery?
Well, I believe the simplest way of really describing it is that in the Arctic, there are certainly some areas that do have observational databases. And so for those remote weather stations, be they in Greenland, be they in the Canadian Arctic, et cetera, we know that the rate of warming was very quick. We know that the temperatures have risen quite quickly. The challenge that we had was, if you have two isolated weather stations, how do you know what's occurred in between there? Is, for instance, the area relatively homogeneous, or is there a lot of heterogeneity? For our method, we decided to incorporate satellite data. We actually provided two methods. We provided one where we simply made an estimate using a form of geostatistical interpolation, and then we provided a second method, which is using satellites to actually guide the interpolation. So we still were using the observational databases to estimate what temperatures were how temperatures were changing in the Arctic, but we used satellite measurements to guide how that interpolation went. So in essence, if we had one weather station located in a remote area, another one located quite a distance away, say 500 kilometers away, using the satellite data, we could say, yes, in between those two areas was also warming at a similar rate. And so then that actually helped us guide in our estimations. So that's one part of the method. Now, the most important part of the method, and the part that you certainly won't see mentioned very often on those websites where they're criticizing the paper and whatnot, is that we also used what's called holdout cross-validation. So we actually reduced the global coverage of the observational record and used our method to estimate what the temperatures would be in all those areas where we actually do have weather stations. Now, this was, so that we could compare what our estimate would have been to what the actual weather station data said for there. And when we did so, we found that certainly using the interpolation method was good, but that the satellite method was vastly superior, and that we actually reduce the error significantly versus doing what Hadley does, which is if they have an area that they don't have a station in, they just leave it out. Well, when you do that, when you leave out, say, an observation because you don't have a station there, then you're assuming that that point is changing temperature at the same as the rest of the globe. Because mathematically speaking, that's what you're doing. And so, in essence, say if you have in the Arctic, if you have all these points in the Arctic that you don't know how quickly the temperature is changing there, and you leave them out, you're assuming that that's all happening at the global average. Now, we know based on a myriad of different sources of evidence that the Arctic tends to have quite a difference from what the actual global average does. And so that in itself provided another means. You know, not only do we use this cross-validation, not only do you use our satellite method, but also whether the results even make sense. And that's an important part of the science as well.
Hearing from you that we're lacking some of the information that we need, and I can't help but wonder, I mean, Canada is a fossil fuel producer, so is Russia. Are we lacking enough research to really know how fast the world is warming? Do we need more research in that?
Well, my own personal view is that certainly, let's say in the last 5 years, there have been a lot, in Canada in particular, there's been a lot of cuts to Arctic research. And that's problematic because, you know, there are certainly a lot of regions there that we still need a better understanding about. And when you cut away research funding, when you cut away positions like with Environment Canada, all those kinds of things, then it ends up that there tends to be a backlog. And the information that scientists need to better inform policymakers just doesn't get out in the same way. And that's the challenge. Now, there are groups that are doing some very good work in terms of trying to collate together as much information as possible. The Met Office group, they have their database, but there are other groups that are assembling larger ones. So I presume that when we actually have those larger databases completely put together and quality controlled and all those things, that we will be able to even have stronger confidence in the results of our studies and other studies in the Arctic. And there are certainly a lot of observational sources that are out there. It's just a matter of combining them all together. And that's always the problem. Data assimilation is a big issue and something that there are a few groups working on.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with University of Ottawa researcher Robert Way. And as you say, Robert, in addition to the major news stories in newspapers like Britain's Independent, your paper stirred up a lot of talk in the climate scientists hangout at realclimate.org, for example. And the critics, some of whom represent fossil fuel interests, granted, took a shot at your credentials being only a postdoc. Has the scientific world tended to block out important work from a new generation of climate researchers?
I have to clarify, I'm a PhD student, not a postdoc, just for clarity purposes. But I think that it's always challenging when it comes to doing research in climate science because, to be honest, you know, you don't go to a university, generally speaking, and do a PhD in climate science. You tend to do it in other things. A lot of people who are climate scientists have physics backgrounds, a lot of geophysics, meteorology, geography. You'd be surprised just how many climatologists are in geography departments, et cetera. So you kind of take these things with a grain of salt. When you see somebody who is using an attack on someone's credentials as a means of trying to dissuade others away from a particular paper, et cetera, that's usually an indication that they don't have a better argument to fall on. And that's what you see. When people attack, say, our credentials or for not being terribly active in the climate science community, it's, for me, I don't really read much into it. And certainly the other thing about it is that, you know, Kevin Cowtan, the lead author of this particular paper, he's very well published in his field, which is computational science. He's got a lot of papers and some ones that have been incredibly highly cited, and he's a fantastic computational scientist. And so certainly in climate science now, a lot of the direction it has moved in is obviously in using computer modeling and using computational type work. So certainly when you take people who have that kind of stats background, that kind of background in computational science and put them in climate science, it's always a benefit rather than something that detracts away from the work.
I'd also like to talk to you about permafrost. My eyes lit up when I saw you've worked with one of the giants of permafrost, Dr. Anthony Lukowitz. He's been a guest on Radio EcoShock. For our listeners all over the world, in general terms, what is permafrost and why does it matter?
Well, permafrost is, in essence, ground that's been frozen for two consecutive years. And in general, it's often much, much longer. And in some places in the world, there's permafrost that's been frozen for hundreds of thousands of years, certainly in areas that weren't glaciated during the last ice age. Permafrost is important for a myriad of reasons. And in particular, in, say, Arctic regions, near Arctic communities, when permafrost degradation occurs, there are a lot of issues that actually affect people. And where I'm from in northern Canada, there's been a lot of communities that have had a lot of issues. When permafrost thaws, ground settles, you get movement. And so one of the challenges is when you build in permafrost, you have things like sometimes the road might collapse. You have buildings that can collapse. You have all those types of issues. And then added to that, compounding the importance of permafrost, you also look at there are certainly large areas of permafrost that contain a great deal of methane. And certainly when you thaw permafrost, that methane is released into the atmosphere. And as we all know, that's also a greenhouse gas and a very powerful one. So certainly there's a bunch of reasons. There's a lot of reasons to study permafrost. And I know that in the popular media now, it seems that there's more of a focus towards the understanding better the way methane may impact our futures.
I'd like to get back to the methane thing, but you know, when I was at a recording of a panel discussion of permafrost at the 2012 meeting of the National Academy of Science, the consensus there was that permafrost melts on a relatively long time scale, like at least hundreds of years. Are we seeing changes faster than that?
Well, I would say that, say, a large region of continuous permafrost will take a very long time to thaw. The challenge is not in necessarily those areas of continuous, although there are challenges. When it's at that threshold where it goes from continuous to discontinuous, that's a problem. But it's really at the southern end of say, the discontinuous zone, where permafrost is not everywhere, but it's in certain spots. And those types of areas can be very sensitive to change. So if you take an area that, say, has permafrost, the annual air temperature is -3, and you warm that area so that the air temperature is close to zero, then it can have quite an impact on the permafrost, and most of it will disappear, and it can happen quickly, and certainly the impacts can happen quickly. Now, whether if you have very deep permafrost in an area, and if, let's say, that region you have something built on top of, say you have a road built on top of, the permafrost doesn't need to thaw to the base of the permafrost for it to cause impacts at the surface. It's, you know, the second you get any thawing, you can have slumping, you can have all these types of impacts that are very important. Whether all permafrost disappears from a particular region or not, that's on the human time scale, that's not as relevant as simply the impacts that can happen.
Well, you know, Robert, some people in North America's crowded cities, and some of our listeners probably, imagine that if the world overheats the way it's been predicted, they'll just move into Canada's north. And, we laugh because I know there's poor soils, there's land made unstable by permafrost, as we're talking about, there's the absence of winter sun and lots of insects. It's harder than anyone would think. What's your opinion?
Well, I'm from northern Canada, and I'll say that certainly there are challenges, let's say, with living in those regions. I really love the north, but I think that not everybody is suited for it, let's say. And you know, I laugh when you mentioned the last part regarding insects. I will say that northern Canada, particularly the wooded areas, are it's a difficult working there sometimes, let's say.
It's a real challenge. I've been there myself. Now, if there was a methane burst, as some scientists have predicted is possible, or if there was a sudden increase in global temperature, could we measure and prove that in real time, or would the accounting come in a year or two later after we've seen big events in the north and around the world?
I have to be absolutely honest. I'm not an expert on methane and certainly permafrost contributions to methane concentrations. So I'd rather not speak to that a whole lot because I don't know. I know there are a lot of individuals who are out there who are very much monitoring this and, you know, have set up more or less real-time monitoring in some areas of things like methane emissions from deep or subsea permafrost and whatnot. But I would much rather if these types of questions were addressed to the real experts on that subject.
Good enough. Well, now, as we wrap up, Robert Way, is there anything else that you would like to talk to us about?
Well, the one thing I would like to say with respect to certainly our paper is the goal was we decided to put the paper in a specialist journal, so it got very tough scrutiny, certainly from experts. It was a very long review process. And we decided to make all our data and all our code that we used to generate it accessible to the public right at the outset. We're working on making the paper open and fully accessible. I don't believe it's done today, but it will be accessible very soon, that it's freely available. Our hope is by making everything available, by making all of this accessible by other scientists and by other, let's say, amateur scientists, that we can in some ways find ways of improving on our work and ultimately better being able to describe global temperature. Our goal is not to be the final word on this particular subject. Our goal is to open the conversation and help the development of methods so that we can really see ourselves moving forward in, let's say, a positive way. We want to see other people criticize our work. As long as it's fair criticisms, we want to see other people replicate our work. The ultimate goal is that 5 years from now, we have a completely robust way of monitoring global temperatures, and I think that our paper is simply a first step in that direction.
From the Geography Department, University of Ottawa in Canada, Robert Ray co-authored a paper that found global warming is at least twice the previously published figures. Robert, what is the title of your new co-authored paper for people who want to look it up?
Our paper is called Coverage Bias in the Hadcrute 4 Temperature Series and its impacts on recent temperature trends. I should mention we also have a website available. It's called Coverage Bias in the Hadcrute 4 Temperature Record. And this website has a briefing document. It has some videos because we've actually made some YouTube videos. Certainly we have a 3.5-minute abstract that gives a description of what we do and has some nice visualizations. On this website, you can also find the methods, the data, the actual series itself, a link to the paper, and also we have a frequently asked questions section that we've put up, which is in response to some of the questions we've already received from other scientists and other individuals. So we've already updated that. I think we've got about 10 frequently asked questions, and we have short descriptions and then longer ones giving detailed answers to some of the questions we received.
Well, that sounds like a goldmine. I'll ask you to email me that link, and I'll put that and some links to other discussion about this paper in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Robert Way, thank you so much for talking with Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you for having the time to talk to me today.
Big Picture Radio right now with Alex Smith. Get it all, ecoshock.org.